They were children of the greatest revolution generation as well. They frustrated, as it were, with the fighting that of that war in Vietnam. Remember that one? They turned on, tuned in, dropped out, and changed the way Americans ate. And so today we pause to ask, how did hippies change the way we eat?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,135th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Saint-Tropez who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Griffin Queener on the boards. Griffin, pre-flight check complete?
We're all good.
All good. And producer Sarah Bell Lynn on the stories. Thank you, Sarah Bell. Folks, they were children of the greatest generation. I was one, I guess. The generation that set aside the business of their days to take up arms, fight and win World War II. But having become frustrated with fighting their own war in Vietnam, they turned on, tuned in, dropped out, and in doing so, ushered in a time of out with the old and in with the new. And that's what we did. We threw it all out. In agriculture, which is the foundation of all culture, that meant to hell with the ways of industrial agriculture and all of its chemical poisons and big money. And in with, well, in with what? The Ecological Farming Association, which as we speak is holding its 38th annual EcoFarm Conference in Pacific Grove, California, is a good example of that searching that went on and is still going on for that great, well, what's next? Way back at its beginnings, EcoFarm was held at La Honda, a small village in the hills above San Francisco, made famous by Ken Kesey and his band of hippie hooligan friends. To feed the conference attendees, organizers relied on the beans and veggies grown by the attending organic farmers, and as a consequence, the breakout sessions closely resembled that campfire scene in Blazing Saddles. You remember that, of course. This weekend's EcoFarm conference is also featuring the produce of its attending farmers, but that food is now of such quality that all the lunches are completely sold out. How did those hippies go about changing the way we eat? So that is our subject today, and who better to work it over than Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Jonathan, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show again, Michael.
Always a pleasure. A food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Now, I have to ask, do food writers ever go hungry?
You know, only by choice, only when we're being good.
Only when you're being good, huh? Well, I suppose being a food writer for the Chronicle would be the great fantasy of many people because there you are right in one of the culinary capitals of the world, and one envisions you going from hoity-toity restaurant to hoity-toity restaurant all day sampling very fine cuisine. Is that what you do?
Not really. No, that is a lovely fantasy. My job is much more telling stories and writing profiles of people who in the food world, and a lot of those folks are folks who are at, you know, small family owned restaurants. I think the people whose stories don't make it into the news quite as often, mm-hmm. because they don't have press agents and marketing campaigns. So that's kind of the thing I get to do at the Chronicle.
You know, I saw a piece in the paper just today wherein most all of these small family-owned businesses in New York City and Manhattan are disappearing. Do you see that trend in San Francisco as well?
We don't. Actually, the neighborhood restaurants, San Francisco is actually a great city to have a restaurant in some ways because people, you know, are on the street. There are people patronize their local neighborhood restaurants. But at the same time, the economic pressures are definitely increasing on restaurants here in San Francisco because of rents and labor costs and all those other costs that, you know, just don't seem to be going down at all.
No, can't think of anything that's going down. Everything's going up. Well, you know, Jonathan, last time we worked together on the food chain, we were talking about test tube meat, how folks are now making meat in test tubes or in test tube vats or what have you. And since we had that conversation, lots more money has been pouring into that industry. I was just wondering, you know, you just finished a book, Hippie Food. I got to wondering, What do you think, Jonathan, hippies would think of test tube meat?
I think it would be the antithesis of everything that they were fighting for.
Kind of what I was thinking too. But you know, and so that was the great revolution. So hippie food, how did you get involved? What was the epiphany? When did the apple fall on your head that, wow, here's a book?
Yeah, so I was a restaurant critic for a number of years before I started doing what I currently do, you know, more profile writing, and I was in Seattle for 4 years, and I decided I was going to write a review about a 30-year-old vegetarian restaurant named the Sunlight Cafe, and I went with some friends of mine who are all my own age, and I was born in the 70s, and we sat down for...
Well, wait a minute, that would make you a Gen Xer then, right?
Totally a Gen Xer.
Okay, good.
The meal they served us was steamed vegetables with lemon tahini sauce and, you know, soy burgers and nut loaves. And I just had this huge hit of nostalgia. And it made me realize, you know, this is food that I have been around all my life. I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and my parents were far from hippies, but in the 1970s we belonged...
Well, they were Mennonites, right?
They were Mennonites, yeah. And so our weeknight dinners were like tofu stir fry with broccoli and African ground nut stew and lentil stews. And so it made me think, like, what is all, you know, where did this food come from? And how did I end up eating it in Indiana? So it took me about 5 years to get around to investigating it, and then it took me 5 years to do the research. But I'm glad the book is finally out.
So that was your food.
It was kind of the origin story of my interest in food, only I didn't realize it at the time because when I was in my teens and younger adults, I mean, I was much more interested in cooking high-end food and eating high-end food.
And then from Seattle, you moved down to San Francisco, and in San Francisco, how can you escape hippiedom?
Well, I live in the Upper Haight as well, so, you know, I see the walking tours every day. But
it's a tour now, right?
Oh yeah, they're walking tours, you know, tourist shop and taking photos of, you know, Haight-Ashbury, people putting on their tie-dye just to come to the neighborhood.
And it's just, so it's still very much there. So there's, you know, you have these two Kickstarters to get this story going. So hippie food didn't just start with hippies, as you just suggested with respect to your Mennonite parents and whatnot. But it went back, you know, quite a ways, hasn't it? Our nation's fascination with what is considered to be health foods.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, when I started looking into the origins of things like whole wheat bread and brown rice and, you know, sprouts and especially whole wheat bread, the very first, I think, one of the very first dietary reformers who started protesting against the industrialization of food supply was Sylvester Graham, who was touring the East Coast in the 1830s.
Graham of the Graham crackers.
Exactly. He didn't invent the Graham cracker, but it was definitely named in his honor. And he was, he was a vegetarian proselytizer, but he also believed that that white bread was, white bread and sugar and coffee and tea were dangerously overstimulating to the body. And he also believed that white flour, was being adulterated in the mills, which very well likely could have. And so those concerns about, white flour and white bread not being nutritious enough and also being adulterated with chemicals were echoed, directly in the 1960s and 70s.
And even, the Kellogg folks, both the brothers. And so there were a number of these people who were really looking at alternative ways of eating and bringing those ways to the public and to finding some acceptance. But then came the hippies, and that's where we're going to go when we get back from this break. Folks, this is the Food Chain radio program. Michael Olson, 1135th edition of the Food Chain. How did hippies change the way we eat? With Jonathan Kaufman, author, Hippie Food. My goodness, I was a hippie once. Were you? Right back. Do stay tuned.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back, and we're talking about, I guess we're talking about America's great cultural revolution that started in the 60s and went through the 70s, 80s. Kind of not sure it's all around that much anymore, although we do a lot of contending. But there was a period there when the children of the greatest generation, the World War II folks, took up arms against the culture in which they lived in and said that they essentially turned on, tuned in, and dropped out, as Dr. Timothy Leary said. And one of the things, great outbranches of that whole movement was the hippies. And here we have a gentleman, Jonathan Kaufman, who insists that those hippies changed the way we eat. Wow, that's a pretty big assertion, but if you look around, it's kind of true, is it not, Jonathan?
I think so.
And, take us back to that. What was it about that time that caused that great upheaval, do you think? Was it just the war, or was it something else?
I think a lot of it had to do with the war, and also, the political unrest, but also I think there was a lot of disillusionment with the government and with any sort of authority figures, and that really extended to food, ideas around food and nutrition, because I think that the baby boom generation at that time, especially the counterculture, was looking for ways to opt out of the larger society and look at ways to build a new community, a new way of living, and also a new way of eating. They were really mistrustful of the processed industrialized food that they were they were raised on.
Well, let me back up just a little bit, because there seemed to be a number of different ways people took action. Some of them, dropped out of culture and moved back to the country and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Some of them became political radicals. I think of like the Weather Underground and whatnot. And so there seemed to be a number of different ways to go. But those that did go kind of back to the country or whatnot, or dropped out of that mainstream culture were kind of forced with the notion of having to tend how to feed themselves, right?
Yeah. You know, it's one thing to say that you're going to move to a tiny town in Vermont and build your own, you know, log cabin. And then it's another thing to get there and realize, how are you going to make money and how are you going to feed yourself?
And so do you think that had a lot to do with the experimentation, early experimentation of different ways of eating, different foods to eat?
I think it would be, yes. I mean, and part of that also was, you know, folks didn't want to rely on the grid or on the industrial food supply, and they wanted to take control of what they were eating and make sure that it was healthy and safe. And so that meant, you know, buying things like whole grains and bulk beans and all of these natural products that then you could, you know, you could buy a sack of wheat berries for very cheap, make your own flour, bake your own bread, which was a really sort of novel thing at the time. And then you knew exactly what you were putting in your body.
You know, I recall visiting some friends of mine, high school friends of mine, who were living in the woods of Montana. And I went to stay with him, and they made dinner, and they handed me a plate of brown rice that was turned brilliant yellow. And I said, "What's this?" And he said, "Oh, it's turmeric. It's the best thing in the world for you." And I looked at him and said, "Well, okay, if you say so." But, you know, they're saying so still.
Mm-hmm.
So that early experimentation, where did they get the information to find these things? Because, Lordy knows, we were living on cheese sandwiches made with white bread and American cheese.
Right. I think people, well, there, one reason, one way that the information spread, and the most common, was that people were talking to each other. I mean, the baby boom generation was very mobile. People were traveling all over the country and sharing all of their ideas with each other.
Grateful Dead, right? Grateful Dead,
yeah,
concerts.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, you know, things like that. And hitchhiking, it just brought people in contact with each other in all these different parts of the country all at once. But I think a lot of where they were getting their ideas, you know, they were looking to the fringe because they didn't trust the USDA or the, you know, Harvard nutritionists who were telling them that processed food is safe. So they began looking at sources like the macrobiotics. That was a big influence on the hippie diet.
What exactly do you mean by macrobiotics?
Macrobiotics was a diet. It was a diet and a philosophy that was introduced to America in 1960 by George Osawa. He's a Japanese man, and he was part of a health movement in Japan that wanted to rid the Japanese diet of Western influences and go back to a peasant diet, which they thought was healthier. And so he brought those ideas to the United States, as well as the idea of that foods were either yin or yang, and so you had to balance the yin and yang in your diet, and that would help you bring you to optimal health and also give you some spiritual clarity.
Can you give some examples of yins and yangs?
Yeah, he believed that Americans were far too yin. So yin food was sugar, alcohol, tropical fruits. Yang food would be meat would be sort of the strongest yang food, but he felt like, you know, Americans were sort of eating at the extremes and then throwing themselves off balance.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, when you think of a macrobiotic diet, think of lots of brown rice, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For him, brown rice was the principal grain. It was kind of the cornerstone of the diet. And, in fact, in George Osawa's, some of his teachings are pretty suspect. And so he believed that if you ate nothing but brown rice for 10 days, you could cure any manner of disease and kind of bring yourself to a spiritual high as well. And so some of the early counterculture kids went a lot farther than 10 days and gave themselves scurvy.
On the road to paradise, right?
Yep.
Well, and you know what? When it gets right down to it, I think our nation has been plagued for as long as I can remember, by strange diets. We seem to have a love for whatever will cure us of everything, and it's so easy. All you have to do is eat this, and away you go.
Yeah.
But the hippies did take up this war against the conventional American diet, kind of turned away from meat, did they not?
Yeah, and for a couple reasons. You know, you had somebody like George Osawa who was saying eat a lot less meat, maybe only eat a little fish. But then in 1971, Frances Moore LePay published Diet for a Small Planet, and she was... She's amazing. I think for me, she's sort of one of my heroes. And she decided to, she was concerned about global famine. And so she went looking in the UC Berkeley agricultural reports, and discovered that, you know, if we fed all of the corn and soy that we were feeding to animals to produce meat, we could actually feed the world. So that inspired a generation, of vegetarians to convert.
Really, who wants to eat all that corn and soybeans? Come on, Frances, goodness sakes. But it did have a big impact on the vegetarian movement and even then the vegan movement after that, right?
Yeah. And it also was a way of looking at food politically that had not been, you know, just wasn't part of the discussion before. This idea that your food choices had a much bigger political impact.
Oh, that sounds like something we simply must pick up after this coming break. So today we're talking, folks, about how hippies changed the world. Now, if you are of the greatest generation, I know how you probably look at hippies, because I remember the day I went back to Montana as a full-blown hippie. I had hair down to my waist, and my father looked at me, my grandfather looked at me, and they shook their head and said, "We've lost our son." Mm. And then I wonder how the Gen Xers looked at that generation. Jonathan being one, our studio guest, Kelly being another. How do Gen Xers look at hippies, those people who go around in patchouli oil and tie-dye T-shirts and whatnot? And then, of course, we have the millennials. And how do they see hippies? Folks, this is The Food Chain. We are talking about hippies and how hippies change the way we are eating today. We have Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, a San Francisco food writer. Who better to write about hippie food than a San Francisco food writer? And you, 831-479-1080, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what's eating what is we are eating food. And a lot of the food we are now eating was kind of given direction by the hippie movement, that great cultural revolution of the 1960s, 70s, and whatnot. Out with the old and in with the new. So long, American cheese, white bread, cheese sandwiches. I remember my brother, who was a construction person up in Montana, got hooked up with a cute little California hippie girl. And she was a vegetarian, and of course, he had to become a vegetarian too. Well, imagine being a vegetarian living on cheese sandwiches in Montana, working in the cold, building things. And so when that relationship ended, of course, he went out and bought himself a big T-bone steak, and away he went. But, you know, that, and it did have a huge impact, because... At one time, you know, a long time ago, we were eating beans and lentils, and now we're going to Chez Panisse in Berkeley and eating these incredibly delicious foods, and coming from that era, coming from the hippies. So big impact. And writing about it is Jonathan Kaufman, food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jonathan, before the break, you made a comment, eating is a political act. What do you mean by that for those folks who haven't given that one any consideration?
Sure. When you look at how people were writing about food, and including vegetarians and Seventh-day Adventists and, you know, folks who were embracing alternative diets before that, people were talking about health, or they were talking about, nutrition, vitamins, getting enough of sustenance to be strong. And then it really, in 1970, that really changed, because I think this generation that was looking at everything very politically, you know, and really kind of questioning the political roots of a lot of different issues, including education and, you know, and of course things like the military. Started thinking about how food could be political too. I mean, the personal was political. So how you made food was political. How food was grown was political. How food was made, and then of course how food was sold was political as well.
Thus, taking us to co-ops, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever shopped at a co-op? Do you remember the hippie food co-ops? Your time, I'm sure.
Shopping at co-ops all my life. My parents joined a co-op in a small town in Indiana in 1976. So that was those are some of my earliest food memories.
And for those folks who have not shopped at a co-op, what exactly are they?
So many of the early co-ops in the 1970s were consumer co-ops, and so they often were very small rooms where people would most of the labor was volunteer, and so if you were going to become a member of the co-op, you had to pledge to work a certain number of hours every week or every month in order to get a price discount or even shop at the co-op. And so they would have basically the supplies they couldn't get in grocery stores, so bulk bins full of, you know, oats and wheat berries and big tubs of peanut butter, and then all of these sort of health food products like, you know, tofu or sprouts or yogurt, you know, things that were very fringe in 1970-75 but had become hippie staples.
And have since become mainstream pretty much.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about co-ops, and of course some of the co-ops here in the little village of Santa Cruz in which I live actually grew up to become grocery stores. Mm-hmm. And then health food supermarkets, and then have been consumed by bigger health food supermarkets and have been pretty much mainstreamed, as it were. And that leads me to the notion of how did this wave of hippiedom wash into contemporary society and I guess get consumed by it, or did hippies make the times, or did the times make hippies?
Well, I think the co-ops were one of the major ways that all of these foods made their way into the mainstream, because mainstream grocery stores very quickly saw that profits were being made. And so, you know, things like granola and yogurt kind of went mainstream very quickly. And then, you know, grocery stores started stocking whole wheat bread on their shelves. And they could, because they were buying things in bulk, they could offer lower prices at a certain point. And because many of the co-ops were run by volunteers and often, you know, people who didn't have a lot of business experience and, you know, working in the lowest profit margin industry in the country. A lot of the co-ops, the early co-ops failed, but the ones that did succeed, you know, became more like grocery stores. They swelled inside, they stocked a broader variety of products, and that's how they stayed afloat.
And some of the foods also were taken into the mainstream, and I think mostly about soybeans and how soybeans became tofu. And then, you know, how hippies brought the whole notion of soy milk.
Yeah.
And how soy milk really caught on. There's a product called Silk was a good example. It became very, very sought after. Here's an alternative to cow's milk. What a wonderful thing. And they had organic Silk soy milk, and the people bought it up. But then along the way, it became not organic soy milk. And today, almost all of the soy products being made are being made with industrial agriculture technologies that include very liberal uses of glyphosate weed killer. So it just seems to me like... what was being sought after got lost in the industrialization.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many ways that the early spirit of the movement got co-opted by capitalism. You know, I think so much of the anti-capitalist underpinnings of the natural food movement in the 1970s just disappeared in the 1980s and the 1990s. People kind of gave up.
Well, have they given up, or have they just, you know, modified? I mean, I'm trying to figure out which one.
Sure.
Did the hippies win, or did the industrial model win? Or is it a contest that's still going on?
I think it's definitely a contest still going on. I think that the critique that the natural foods movement was offering in 1970 is just as trenchant today. But at the same time, you know, the food is even more industrialized than it was in 1970.
And there you go. So the revolution goes on, as it were. When we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about how that conflict is going on, especially, you know, with things such as meat, as we were talking about earlier, the test tube meats being funded by people like Bill Gates, lots and lots of money going into these things, and that contest between them and organic agriculture. And look what's happened to organic agriculture. Big changes all around. So much of it influenced by hippies, as outlined in the book Hippie Food by Jonathan Kaufman, food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Now, what about you out there? What is your favorite hippie food? 831-479-1080. We will be right back after these very important messages.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Jonathan Kaufman. He, the Generation Xer from Indiana, a Mennonite family who grew up on hippie food but never knew it as hippie food. It was his food. Jonathan, as a Gen Xer, when you look at hippies, what do you think of their food?
Well, when I was growing up, and I think when I was a teenager and a young adult, I just found it, you know, heavy and bland, and it, you know, it wasn't the food that my peers were eating, and it wasn't the food that I wanted to eat. But as I get older, I realize, you know, how both how much healthier it was, but I also think that a lot of the food that, you know, whole grain food that we would call maybe hippie food has gotten so much better in the past 40 years. It's got a lot more vegetables. It's brighter. There are more flavors and ingredients that people are incorporating in it. And so something like a grain bowl, you know, that I think, you know, baby boomer generation, look at that and they think, oh gosh, this is hippie food. And to me, it's really delicious. You know, millennials are eating it because it actually tastes good.
Well, speaking of millennials, Griffin, are you eating hippie food?
No, not really. I'd have to say that it definitely has gotten better, though. I think even from what I can remember, it used to be much worse in general. But I do know a lot of people that are vegetarian and vegan. My sister's a vegan, and she seems to be doing fine. She runs 10 miles every other day and is a very healthy person, so it's got to be good for you.
There you go. Well, okay, Kelly, what do you think? You're a Gen Xer, right?
That's right, yeah. And I grew up in kind of a half-hippie home.
Half-hippie home?
Yeah, and by that I mean my mom did not allow us to have white bread. So we had wheat bread, and, you know, everyone in my household kind of used marijuana. So I'd say I grew up in a half-hippie home. And
what was the other half?
The other half was working class, you know. You know,
steak and eggs.
Yep.
So what are you now?
I would say I'm a half hippie.
Half hippie?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. You know, in thinking about what I've seen through the years, and I'm thinking about, to me, the biggest perhaps impact on hippie food is in agriculture. You know, many years ago, I attended one of the first EcoFarm conferences at La Honda, as I mentioned in the introduction to this segment. And it really was very, very, very primitive. The food they served themselves was very primitive. I mean, nobody knew how to cook beans yet, you know. So it was pretty devastating after a while. But, you know, today EcoFarm is going on at Pacific Grove, and the food that they're being served now is still grown and processed by member farmers. But, my goodness, it's good. It's delicious food. And as we go into, you know, conventional agriculture, it is having a big impact on how we feed ourselves. Organic food is now the organic food and free from food, which is to say foods free from this and free from that, free from gluten, free from pesticides. Those free from foods are now the fastest growing category of foods in the supermarket. So industrial agriculture does have to pay attention. And of course, they are paying attention. But as they do pay attention, you know, they have a way of slinging their money around and having a big impact on what is organic agriculture now. So today you see where organic hydroponics, foods growing in water, are now going to be considered organic. So how far into the future do you think hippie foods can survive?
I think that they're going to be with us for quite some time, because I think the thing that did for me, the beyond organics, which was definitely one of the most important legacies of the counterculture food movement, the other important legacy was really looking at what is a healthy diet. And back in 1970, nutritionists were saying, oh, you know, whole wheat bread has the same nutrition as white bread, and oh, you can eat sugar and soda as long as it's just part of a healthy diet. But now, when you look at the USDA dietary recommendations, they say eat less meat, eat more fruits and vegetables, make half of your grains, you know, whole grains, eat less sugar. They're all the things that were coming out of the hippie movement that were really fringe, you know, 50 years ago.
And so not so fringe anymore. So what you say is probably true. Hippies did have a big impact on the way they changed what we eat today. Question then, when we get back from this break, with one more break, so much to talk about with Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food. I want to know where it will take us in the future. Those tune in and drop out people who shucked conventional American culture so many years ago. Where will that take us in the future in the contention with that industrial model? Right back. Do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, if you think about it and think back to the times of the 60s and 70s, those of you who are around can remember that, period of great upheaval, fed up perhaps with the ways of the world, fueled by the antipathy toward the Vietnam War and whatnot. The hippies kind of turned things, everything they could, essentially, upside down and shook it all out. And one of the enduring legacies of that period, according to Jonathan Kaufman, author of Hippie Food, would be the way that those hippies reshaped the way we look at eating our food, how we think about eating our food, and what we look for in the food we eat. Gosh, the changes wrought on the food chain are huge since that time. Seems to me, as somebody who is an observer, somebody who's done 1,135 radio shows on food, that the whole system, the food system, is kind of growing in two different directions. One is very, very big, and the other is very, very small. And that huge industrial model is doing a great job of picking up ideas from the smaller side. And I'm wondering, Jonathan, do you think that hippie ethic of small and handcrafted foods and organic foods and foods free from all of those things that industrial agriculture likes to put in them, do you think it'll survive as we go forward into the future?
I hope so. You know, and at the same time, I really hope that we can find ways. One of my main priorities is to get clean, healthy, ecologically, you know, sustainable food onto everyone's plates. And we're seeing that as well. I think there's a possibility. There's a mix of big and small, you know, answers to this conundrum.
Mm-hmm. What would they be?
Your guess is as good as mine. No, I'm hoping that we continue to put pressure on government agencies and to change the way they subsidies and marketing programs and all that money that goes to support industrial agriculture that more and more of it can be funneled toward small local organic agricultural systems. That's a big one. And I think, consumer demand continues to be a major force in promoting, organic agriculture and bringing good, clean, healthy food to everyone.
Power of the purse.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, how do you use the power of your purse?
Well, I want to mention I just signed up for a food delivery service, mm-hmm. and it comes with organic ingredients in the recipe.
Would you buy it if it didn't come with organics, if it was like conventional food growing?
Probably, because I'm a half hippie. Yeah, I probably would. But I'm very excited, to get this box. It's coming next week, and I'm going to get 3 meals for 4 individuals and with the recipes. And, I think it's a great way to grab some organic ingredients and make a great meal at home.
Well, which is the way to do it if you're half hippie. That's right. And aren't we all half hippies? But what about you? Are you half hippie, Jonathan?
No, I totally am a half hippie. I eat vegetarian at home, and then I eat everything else when I'm out of the house.
There you go. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan Kaufman, for joining us again on The Food Chain, the book Hippie Food. Look it up, pick it up, read it, and learn a little bit about how hippies shape the way we eat. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is a foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.